The young man was fairly formed, comely. He was bound and tied. There could be no movement. There was a knife at his jugular. The day before yesterday's headlines, yes. And also the required classic Torah reading for the New Year's Day. The Akedah. The story of the sacrifice of Isaac, the most loved son, has suddenly materialized from myth into reality. And our contemporary version is crueler and starker by far. Where there is no German official caught in the net who can offer himself as a hostage, no surrogate sacrifice like the ram that was caught in the thicket by its horns. Only death. No conclusion. 11 graves have been opened and 11 graves have been closed. We Jews do not spend over much time with the rituals of mourning. The world has played for us Beethoven's funeral march and offered us the messages of condolence, well phrased. They've had much practice. The analyses have been offered. We've searched for explanation. And suddenly we find ourselves on the new year. We know that we must move from mourning to meaning. That we must go behind concern with the immediate to try to find the deeper understanding. The games go on. The flag was dipped, returned to full mast. The world has returned to its ordinary routines. And the question is, was this the single, aberrant, accidental act of fanaticism? The moment of terror which comes now and again, like the arrow that speeds at noonday, but is it of itself not of the very texture of life? Was this the exceptional, the unexpected? It is the only response that man can make in order to maintain his composure, his equilibrium, his sanity. Go back to the ways of living, to return to his games, his ceremonies. Is there no other meaning? I am burdened by that strange juxtaposition of myth and the moment. How often in our history the events of the past suddenly shape themselves into the themes of the moment. I'm burdened by the sense that somehow history is speaking through this moment. Our fathers 2,000 years ago in Palestine, when they drew up the schedule of readings for the holy days, could not have known that the 20th Olympiad and Arab terrorism and the Rosh Hashanah would come in just such juxtaposition. Perhaps there's some deeper meaning. And I find the deeper meaning in the sense of history itself, seems to speak through this moment, which says to me, the sacrifice, the binding, the sudden intrusion of terror on life has happened before, and it will happen again. Those who deny the lessons of history, who will not listen to the lessons they do not want to hear, who will not accept a description of life which is too dark and too grim for them, these are the innocents. And they are doomed. For life will ultimately trip them up, and their fall will be the harder. Their souls will be shattered because they have been not been prepared for the shadow, for the darkness. The force of history burdens the soul of the Jew. Certainly it burdens my soul. Now I have many good friends who tell me that this ought not to be so. The force of history is interesting, perhaps, but irrelevant. History is a dead study, inert. Let the dead be buried. There is no resurrection. But there is no value in listening to the voices of the past, of trying to understand the ways in which men have reacted to the past to try and draw some lessons for today. Indeed, to do so is to be reactionary and to be blind. The past counsels caution and prudence. And no one who reads of the past can have a very romantic view of human nature. But these, my friends, tell me are precisely the cautions that modern man, the new man, must shake off. For yes, they tell me there is a new breed. People who have won through to a new level of consciousness, a new set of values, a new understanding of what is demanded, a new freedom, a new sensitivity and preciousness. They must not be burdened, these few, with the lessons of the past, for they have finally shaken themselves loose of their environment, of their conditioning, and now they are free and open and genuine and receptive. And they can stimulate genuineness and openness and receptiveness and love in others. The past, I am told, is reactionary. For the past is a dismal record, a dismal chronicle of the failures of men, their pretensions. The past is full of the platitudes of peace and justice and love. But the record of the past is a record of man's inhumanity to man, of cruelty, war, and murder, and brutality, and ostracism, and apartheid. And the man of the past, I am told, the man of the past was what he was because he was conditioned to be so by all the institutions of men, by the state, and by the laws of that state, and by arbitrary authority, and by a church which consecrated the values of the past, and by schools which encouraged the questions of rank and status, all the assumptions of the past. We have put these behind us, we the new breed. We are free. We are open. We are genuine. We must live without the burden of the past because we must live in our innocence. And somehow by living in this new spirit, this sense that history begins with us today, will awaken in our souls and in the souls of others their true humanity. for the philosophy, obviously, which undergirds this whole theory, is that man is by nature good. And it is only the institutions of men which brutalize, which destroy, which force out of us the juice of love, which corrode in us our will, our capacity to be responsive and to be sensitive, which rust our spirit. There is the historical man and there is the natural man. And I'm told by these modern messianists that increasingly there are to be found among the young and the not so young, or those who respond to the young, men and women in communities in which the past has been forgotten, in which a new breed of people who will have emerged. God wish it were so. Surely it's a noble hope. None of us can look at the record of the past and be that much encouraged. But I wonder. I remember the Pied Piper. I recall the slaughter of the innocents. I remember that there were 11 at Munich who forgot themselves for a moment, who got caught up in the spirit of the games, who let down their security. And I wonder. I look about me at these new communities, these new sensitives, and I see them breaking up in bitterness almost as quickly as they form. I hear of those who are the flower children, the loving, the sensitive. And I hear of how they are abused and taken advantage of on the street. I wonder if one can truly live as an innocent. And I wonder if the innocent truly knows how much he is protected and sustained by the society, the callous, cruel, historically conscious society, which he often so misprizes. Nor I am afraid that, for better or for worse, the lesson that the headlines, the history of this holiday, the lesson of our faith, the lesson about this new year and any year is the historical lesson. Why was the Akeda chosen as the reading for this day? It's a tale of courage and commitment, but there are many tales of courage and commitment in the Bible. It was chosen because it symbolized to the Jew the very nature of life itself, of yesterday and today and tomorrow. Vayisa Adonai et Abraham. And God tested Abraham. Life is a test. Life is a trial. And in the test, there's really no letting down of the guard. Abraham, by the time that he was tested, was an elderly man. He had begun as a wanderer, and now he was settled. He was begun as a minor sheikh, and now he was acclaimed as the head man of the whole area. He had been sonless most of his life, and now suddenly he had that which he prized more than life itself. Vayisa Adonai et Abraham. But God came along and tested Abraham, even as we are all tested, continually. Every year. History burdens us. Burdens us with the reality that so many of us, not only the young, would eschew. How many of us have tried to build the good life, to find some place in some sylvan, secluded glen, some quiet street, a piece of green, quiet doors of a home, a place of security and peace where we could drop out and let the world pass us by. How many of us have wanted to live only with decency, to live and to let live, But the world does not allow it. The world, life is not a game, unfortunately. Life is cruel and often grim and full of the unexpected. And that's the lesson of the year. To live without these kinds of false romantic illusions. Out of rubble, state was created. 6 million lives had gone down the charnel house. All we asked, menucha, peace, to drop out into our little pioneering experiment, a little bit of wasteland which we would somehow water and turn green and fertile. 25 years have passed. Where's the rest? Where's the world's willingness to allow a few refugees to find their dignity? Let me speak of burden, of history, of these Olympics. Let me talk of the reverberations of the past which somehow must be allowed into our consciousness if we are to live with any sense of conviction, with any sense of useful purpose, if we are to live in this world and not some dream world, born of abundance, born of ideology, born of romanticism, matters not. There was a meeting about 5 weeks ago of a committee to organize the 25th anniversary celebration here in Cleveland of the creation of the State of Israel. And we were told that the first item in this celebration would be the arrival in Cleveland of a flame. There was to be a flame lit this New Year's in Jerusalem, and lights which had been touched to that flame would be taken to all the major Jewish communities of diaspora, where they would remain flaming, alive, symbolic, during the 25th anniversary year. This flame will arrive in Cleveland during the Sukkot holiday. The public relations agency in New York, which had been asked to coordinate this program, had heralded it as the 25th anniversary torch. And suddenly, history burdened my soul. I found myself the rabbi. I wondered about this image of the torch. A torch brought to Cleveland from Jerusalem in late September, only a month after another torch had been brought from Olympia to Munich for quite another purpose. And I wondered at the juxtaposition of symbols. Yes, light and freedom. These are understandable in our tradition. Had not the Maccabees relit the lights of the temple when suddenly it had become ours again? But a torch at this time, I wondered. There were vibrations, historical vibrations, that I suddenly sensed that burdened my spirit. And I spoke up a bit. And I wondered aloud about the use of the word torch, perhaps a flame. Perhaps the Hebrew word lapid or ner. Torch, Olympic. My history reminded me how the games themselves were organized to glamorize and to glorify the worst racism the world knew to Hitler came upon this earth. The great Aryan myth. Only the true-blooded Greek might participate in the games. And the games were idolatrous, dedicated to the pagan gods. And all around the game there was a stench of homosexuality. Only men were admitted. And the physicalness of the athlete was not only applauded, but adored. What has this to do with the light that is to come from Jerusalem? Light which is to be the light of Torah, to enlighten the eyes of the prisoner and those that are in the dungeon in the prison house. And I reminded myself how when Alexander had brought some version of the Greek games throughout the Middle East, some of the jeunesse dorée, the golden youth, the Shaker Heights pepper pike youth of Jerusalem had been attracted by the games, and how they had gone down to Tyre where these games were held, and how they had participated in the games, all the idolatry and all the values of immodesty which were implicit. And the attractiveness of these games to these young people helped to create the generation gap, which is at the very base of the Maccabean Revolution, which was essentially a reaffirmation of traditional Jewish values against those of the Greeks. And I wondered about the torch. It will not be called in Cleveland the 25th anniversary torch, but the 25th anniversary flame. But not because the rabbi heard history, not because he heard the reverberations of the past. Why, after all, Rabbi, Israel is participant in these Olympic Games. But this fall, at about the time this torch was to arrive, we're to have our United Torch campaign. And public relations carried the day. I forced them to pause long enough to think of another reason. But I couldn't shake from my mind these negative vibrations, the young people would say. The sense of history, the sense that something was wrong. All this business about the games. I knew that Israel was participating, that there would be Jewish athletes from the world over. Yet I wondered, I couldn't help remembering another Olympic, not so many years ago, 1936, Berlin. Again, it was an Olympic Games to celebrate a new Germany, Hitler's Germany. There were great massive stadia. There was a great massing of youth and of troops. It was a display of the power of the Third Reich. And I remember how before those games, many of the men of goodwill in the world, and certainly many in our own Jewish community, had protested the participation by the Western nations, the free nations, in these games, led by a man who spouted the ugliness of the master race, who was little by little turning off and destroying the ability of the Jewish community in Germany to survive. Just months before the games, he had gone to Nuremberg and proclaimed there the racial laws. No one listened. The games were attractive. They were a great spectacle. Americans, sentimentalists that we are, we remember these games as the moment when a black man, Jesse Owens, by a speech, showed up the racial myth. Hitler was not fazed by Jesse Owens, whatever his speed and skill. Hitler proved his point at Berlin. The world was impressed. The world sensed the power of the Third Reich. The world, it was a quick step, an easy journey, 2 years, from Berlin to Munich. Peace in our times, a willingness to give in, to bend before the tyrant. The world had heard and seen and had been impressed. And I thought of Munich. I thought as a Jew of Munich. The town is a beautiful town. If you come in as an American sportscaster, not as a rabbi, you see the beauty, the quaintness, the dress of the peasant, the beer halls, the laughter, the dancing, the lushness of the forests and the countryside. How can you not be impressed? But a rabbi sees with other eyes. He knows that Munich is not that old a town. It was founded in the 12th century. The Jews were among its first citizens. But that in the year 1285, the pious of Munich brought a charge of blood libel against the Jewish community. We had used a Christian child as a sacrifice during the Passover festival, or so it was alleged. And the entire community was driven into the synagogue, a wooden building, and the synagogue was torched. Genocide. The Jews tried to return to Munich, and a few did. And in 1348 and 1349, the Black Death passed over Europe. And the Jews of Munich were accused of poisoning the wells. And again there was a pogrom. And again there was genocide. And again a few Jews tried to come back to this picturesque and lush little community. And in 1415, another of the pious of Munich accused the Jews of having desecrated the host used in the Mass. And again there was a pogrom. And those who were not killed were exiled. And for 300 years, Munich was Judenrein, without any Jews. And Jews came back to Munich only in the 18th century, only when the Landgrave and the Duke and the Bishop and the Elector required Jewish factors, Jews who knew something about the new organization of finance. 20-some-odd families were allowed into Munich. Allowed there, but without any rights of domicile. If a mother was about to give birth to her child, she had to travel 90 miles to Stuttgart. No Jewish child might be born in Munich. If a Jew died in Munich, his body had been to be taken all the way out of Bavaria. No Jew might be buried in that holy soil. And it wasn't until the armies of Napoleon, the French armies with the banners liberty, equality, fraternity, came through Germany that this little insular town so invested with hereditary anti-Semitism began to allow some Jews to live there by right. They were never accepted. They were never part of the larger community. They were never ghettoized in the sense that there was a wall, but they were ghettoized socially and in every other way. During the 19th century, perhaps 8,000-10,000 Jews lived in Munich on sufferance, excluded from these beer halls and from the social clubs and from the university. But they lived there. And they contributed their share and more to the upbuilding of the institutions of their community. And they contributed twice their number proportionally to the German armies of the First World War. When the armies returned to Munich in defeat, the Jew was the scapegoat. Munich was one of the centers of Hitler's power during the 20s. Here was the center of Nazi support, of anti-Semitism in its form. Here, Himmler and Heydrich had their origins. It was not a matter of chance that Hitler established his first concentration camp, Dachau, just several kilometers outside of Munich. He knew no one here would really object. Rabbi, you're burdened with history. Madiavad avad, what's past is past. This is a new Germany. After the Second World War, dear friends, about 1,800 Jews returned to Munich, mostly the older and the elderly. They established a school, a little synagogue. Twice that synagogue has had swastikas painted on its walls. Just 2 years ago, someone broke into the synagogue and destroyed the Torah in the Ark. The cemetery has 3 times been desecrated. And just 2 years ago, someone, no one yet knows whom, set fire to the Jewish old folks' home in Munich. And 7 patients lost their lives. That, unfortunately, is the kind of memory with which a rabbi is burdened. The past does not die so easily. This is not yet quite brave, new, wonderful world. But this was to be an international Olympics. There was no Jewish question in these Olympics. I was prepared to find myself wrong. But most of this week, I've unfortunately been home and been in bed, and I've watched these Olympics. And suddenly, I found on the screen in front of me a symbolic drama which highlights the tragedy and the heroism of the Jew in the diaspora. What have these Olympics to do with the Jew? What have they highlighted but the Jew? How many are we? 11 million? 12 million? In a world of what? 2.5? 2.75 billion? A fraction? A fraction? A fraction of a percent? And who is the athlete who is driven to excel, to win more gold medals than anyone in Olympic history? A Jew. What makes Mark Spitz swim? What makes Sammy run? Is it only talent? Training? Hardly. I kept hearing reverberations in these commentaries of how he had been challenged 4 years ago at another Olympics and at other times as Jew boy, driven to excel because only if he did that much better than anyone else would anyone pay attention. And his reward? The reward of all the Sammies, all of us. He's brash. He's aggressive. What else could he be? Well, I thought perhaps there's no more important lesson in the Olympics than that. I'll simply sit back and enjoy them. And since this is Munich, I'll root for every Czech athlete that comes on the screen. But that was not to be. And suddenly it was the Israel flag that I saw, not rising on some pole in triumph for some medal in some race, but at half-mast. Suddenly I heard of violence, of hostages. And I heard that these good Germans were so proud of their Olympics that for a whole day while these hostages were under the gun, they had to watch canoeing and swimming and basketball on their television. And only the most ferocious kind of international protest finally turned off the television, turned the games off for a few hours. And I wondered. And I wondered. By strange coincidence, the night before the tragedy, the television showed a visit by athletes, it turns out by Jewish athletes and Israeli team mostly, to Dhaka. There was a service there. It seemed to be very moving. There was to be at least some recognition that of what Germany had been. And over the walls of Dachau, over the gate, the announcer said, is the line from Santayana, that he who does not know his history is bound to relive it. We Jews say it this way, Zachor, remember. It comes from a biblical phrase, Zachor et Amalek, remember Amalek. The Amalekites were people who lived on the other side of the Jordan, and when the children of Israel were passing up the Jordan to go towards Jericho and their entry into the promised land, Moses asked the king of Amalek for right to pass through his land. He would pay for whatever waters or provisions the Jews achieved. They had no interest in the Amalekites, and they hoped the Amalekites had no interest in them. And the Amalekites said, pass through. And the Jews in peace began to move through, and suddenly at night, from the rear, the Amalekites attacked, and they pillaged, and they murdered. Zachor et Amalek. Remember the sudden intrusion of tragedy, of cruelty, of violence, of the Pharaoh in man. This has been a necessary reminder for Jews in every generation. Even at the games, Zachor, remember, Zachor et Amalek. That's, unfortunately, the message that I, as a rabbi, must leave with you this New Year's Day. To remember. Have you asked yourself why it is that the Israelis alone among the civilized nations seem able to handle the guerrilla and the terrorist? I think the answer lies in this. They live without illusion. They know that they are the object of attack. They know that these attackers cannot be bought off. The more you give them, the more their appetite is wet. They know that they cannot ultimately be parlayed with. Human pathology is such that it needs to be exhibited. They need their moment of glory and of glorious death. They know that there may be a price in the lives of innocents if they attack. But the price must be paid, else the price becomes that much heavier. All the other nations live as if they have forgotten something about the other, the blacker, the darker, the crueler, the more feral nature of man. We try to bargain, we try to reason, we try to purchase, to buy off, and it doesn't work. We only stimulate others to try the same desperate acts. To live without romantic illusion, it's not easy, but it must be. And it's particularly difficult for us who are coming off decades of abundance, of peace, of seeming security. How Jews have quivered these last few years, suddenly to discover that the era of growing goodwill seemed in certain ways to be closing for us, that suddenly that there were quotas and we were at the wrong side of the quotas, suddenly that there was affirmative action on behalf of certain minorities and we were the minorities from which opportunity was being taken. It's not been easy for us to recognize that among many of the parts of the nation, the old words of hate, the old shibboleths of anti-Semitism are being surfaced and heard again. And it's not been easy for most of us who live in these wondrous surroundings to recognize just how far the amenities of the world in which we live have deteriorated about us. How much of the simple freedom we once had to walk about our city, to leave our homes open and unlocked, to live without electronic sensors to make sure that we are safe at night, to live with a certain grace and charm, how much of that has been stripped from us. And many are not prepared for the social cost of social change. So they complain on the one hand of losing their privilege and at the other hand of the higher costs of living and the lower amenities which they see about us. We have not looked life head on. We have not been prepared for the world as it really is. Remember what life is truly like. But Rabbi, a Shana Tova, something good. This is a time for hope, for expectancy. We pray, grant us, O Lord, a year of happiness, a good year. I wish it to you with all my heart and with all my soul. But it can be a good year only in terms of which human years can such terms as human years can produce.
What has happened, I'm afraid, is that our hopes, our expectations have overvaulted the possibility, the reality. And most of us look for rewards which no year can give us. There are times that are good. There are moments that do give us joy. There are family occasions. There are moments of quiet and security and happiness. There is peace sometimes, but not always. The new year, it will have its moments for us, but it will be a time of testing and of challenge. For all men, not only Jews, are alienated men, marginal, uprooted, conditioned, determined, if you will, by the times. Those of you who would persevere, you will not find your encouragement in high, vaunting dreams, but in reality itself. For ultimately, the burden of history is not only to be realistic, to be prepared for the unwanted and the unexpected, to see man as human being and human beast as a complex, to see history in the long term, is to see history, is to hear not only the darker reverberations, but the brighter ones. Here we are, you and I, the 40th, 100th, matters not, generation of Jews. For 40 centuries since that first Akedah, we have suffered the slings and arrows of an outrageous fortune. We have been bound and we have been slaughtered at times. And here we are, decent people, civilized people, humane people, people who are creative, who have given to the world far more than we have harassed it. There's no bloodlust in our people. There's no cry for vengeance among the multitudes, the sane. Here we are. Historical proof of what men can be and mankind can become, where there is love and where there is wisdom and where there is understanding, but most of all, where one begins with a realistic appraisal of what life is. The terrorist is a child who lives in some impossible childish dream that by a single act he can turn the world over and make it as he wants it to be. And the world is filled with child men who will not accept life with all of its confusion and of all of its challenge for what it is, who insist on living in a dream world of their own devising. We've lived in the real world. We've accepted it and not been brutalized by it. We've surmounted it. We found courage, encouragement in our faith. The Akedah, the lesson. Life is a trial. Be prepared. There is no security. Life is a trial, but how does the Akedah end? Not as Munich ended, with a ram caught in the thicket. Isaac is not to be touched. The ram is to be offered in his stead. And the tradition has it that that ram caught in the thicket had its horn taken up by God into heaven, the shofar. And that is the shofar that will sound sometime in the golden time when truly the world of dreams for which all men hope will have come into reality. Lose your illusions. Gain happiness. Gain this possibility of true accomplishment in the new year. Amen.